ignition sequence start. 3, 2, 1.
Range is hot. Lock and load. It's time for the gun rack with your hosts, Joey and Drew.
Hello and welcome to the Gun Racks and Lord Desert Institute School of Firearm Technology's official podcast. I'm Josiah Upper. Folks call me Joey, and today I am alone. Sorry, folks, for a bit of a lapse in schedule here. I'm sure that Drew would want me to tell you all it is entirely my fault, and fortunately for him, he is correct this time. I was covering our bases. Drew and I were both out of town this past weekend, and I did not have the time that I thought I was going to make this happen, but we're going to play catch-up now, and we are going to benefit a little bit from my travels. So look forward to getting that incorporated in here. And those travels were actually to, Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia, where I spent, as you might imagine, a significant amount of time in the gunsmith shop. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about a firearm that I had done almost no looking into prior to my time there, and I look forward to covering this with you guys. I think it's really cool. A lot of folks are under the impression that the primary firearm that was in common use throughout the colonial era in colonial America was the musket, and that's actually not true. And we're going to talk about why that's not true and walk through some of the things that that means for us as historians here in the gun rack as we walk through our little history tour here. But short answer is, we were not using muskets because we were using something called a fowling piece, and we're going to walk through what that means right now. But before we do, actually, let's talk a little bit about Sonoran Desert Institute. So Sonoran Desert Institute is an online accredited school focusing in programs on firearms and unmanned technology. We currently offer 4 main programs. You've got your Certificate in Unmanned Technology Aerial Systems, Certificate in Firearms Technology Handgun Specialist, Certificate in Firearms Technology Gunsmithing, and of course, the Associate of Science in Firearms Technology degree. And if you wish to learn more about any of these programs or simply more about what we do here over at Sonoran Desert Institute, simply hop over to sdi.edu for more. Now, let's hop into some history. We're going to dive into the tales of rugged adventurers, rangers, and scouts who carved out the frontiers of empires with courage, grit, and a trusty firearm. We're going to be focusing on the Fowler piece today, and this came into existence long before the iconic rifle that the United States is so famous for now became a staple of American lore. The Fowler was a real workhorse on the colonial frontier. These weren't just any guns. They were versatile, really large bore firearms essential for survival. They're capable of hunting a variety of game and doubling as military weapons when needed, although game was definitely going to be their primary MO out there. And actually, before we get too much further into this, I'd like to go ahead and acknowledge sources so I can get that out of the way. We used actually quite a few sources in putting this together, including an interview with some folks over at Colonial Williamsburg from American Rifleman, Frontier Partisans, which is run by Jim Cornelius. I'm hoping I'm reading that right because the font he used for his name is a lot. Meat Eater, the particular article is called The Guns of the American Pilgrims by Jordan Sillars, and then Positive Shooting by Mike Yardley. A Brief History of the Sporting Gun. That's what we're looking at today. All right, let's hop back into it. Our journey through all of these begins in the swamps and marshlands of Europe, where the Fowler was initially developed for hunting waterfowl. I probably didn't need to break that one down, but there you go. Tom Grinslade, an expert in the field and author of 18th Century American Fowlers, the First Guns Made in America, explains how these firearms made a difference in making their way to America with Dutch settlers, influencing regional gun-making traditions, especially in the Hudson Valley. Now, the Hudson Valley Fowlers were renowned for their exquisite craftsmanship, and I think beautifully carved stocks and intricately embraved brass hardware, a lot of the stuff that when you go to museums you see today. It's really cool stuff. But what truly set these Fowlers apart was their length. They were huge, and the size of their butts, huge, huge stocks on these things, balancing out sometimes over 4 foot long barrels. And speaking of those, Fowlers had them in space. They weren't for show. A hefty butt helped stabilize the gun and made it a lot easier to handle, just to balance out that ridiculously large barrel. The club butt Fowler, which might win the award for the goofiest name in firearms history, with its distinctive, it's got a really large bulbous stock, is a perfect example of this design philosophy. The club butt Fowler became a favorite among the Native American tribes, actually, when they became involved in the fur trade, and its quality and craftsmanship made it extremely desirable, often marking clocking in at twice the fur as a standard trade gut would. I have anecdotally some evidence from my conversations directly with the gunsmiths there over at, or gun sellers, actually, over at Colonial Williamsburg, who said that a white-tailed deer was worth $1, and $4 equaled a Spanish dollar, and a few of those would equal the worth of your rifle. So we're talking about a pretty significant amount of capital being involved in these things, especially if you're doubling the price of a standard trade gun. Now, these guns were just used for hunting and combat. They were loaded with what was called swan shot, and were pretty formidable weapons, and despite their size and lack of a bayonet, the club butt Fowler was a preferred firearm for the New England Rangers throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, which I think you can see in Turncoat, but don't quote me on that one. It's kind of interesting to note that not everyone finds a club butt Fowler aesthetically pleasing. I imagine we'd say the same thing about a Glock today. Although if you think a Glock is aesthetically pleasing, you're wrong. However, its effective and distinctive style have left a lasting impression on American firearm history. Much like the lines of a certain rap song echo its appreciation for prominent curves. Whether it's a matter of form or function, these Fowlers tell a story of adaptation, craftsmanship, and survival. They're a testament to the rugged individualism that defined the American frontier. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about, can you tell my outline ended one of the subheadings right there? No, I want to talk a little bit more about Colonial Williamsburg, because the experience there is really cool. I highly recommend it. I think living history is cool as hell, but that's not really the point. Their gunsmith shop is one of the coolest I've ever seen, and I kind of make a point of going out and checking living history gunsmith shops, modern gunsmith shops. I've been in the firearms industry for kind of a while now, actually. Oh, that's wild to think about. And Colonial Williamsburg's was one of the better ones I've ever seen. It's right by the Capitol Building, if you're familiar with that, which is one of their most famous attractions there. And their history there is, it's on display, yes, but it's also actively being made. A lot of folks go through and they are like, oh, wow, those props are really cool, right? Technically, sure, they're props, but they're active. Everything in there is being made there. They do that stuff in-house, and while that may be difficult to believe, I can assure you it's absolutely true. I do a lot of work with living history museums, and it's cheaper for them to do it authentically and historically. So that's what they do. Master Gunsmiths, actually, Richard Sullivan is the one who was involved in the American Rifleman article. So I'm going to start throwing him in here. And his apprentices were employing period tools and techniques to create these flintlock rifles, just like it was done centuries ago. And the same was true of when I went there, not just this interview. It's not a reenactment. It's living history, crafts, historical trades. The process is going to begin with the forging of a rifle barrel, which, is an immensely precise, It's really hard. And of course, we're talking about rifle barrels. This is a little bit of a Williamsburg side piece to the fouling piece, but it's all good stuff. So They use, of course, a traditional forge. The gunsmiths heat these strips of wrought iron until it is white hot, and then they hammer them around a steel, I believe it's called a mandrel, correct me if I'm wrong in that, in the comments. This forms a barrel, which is initially shaped into that octagonal profile, which is pretty well known now. It's done that way to indicate a rifle's rifled nature, right? If you go and you look at muskets, frequently you'll find that round barrel, but rifles are going to have that octagonal barrel. And a lot of us who run around with, I have a Pedersoli 50 cal that I use for black powder season. If you have something like that, you will probably notice an octagonal barrel there as well. Anyway, the temperature of the forge, the traditional forge, is judged by eye. The colors of the metals and the sparks guiding the hands of the gunsmiths, which I thought was really cool. Art of the barrel making is crucial, as the strength and balance of the rifles can hinge on their ability to fuse and shape that metal right. If you screw it up, you're in trouble. But the craftsmanship doesn't stop there. The screws, the metal, every part's going to be handmade. If you've ever gotten your quote for how much it would cost you to get a Williamsburg rifle, because they do them to order, you know that it is handmade. Each component's made, it's filed, it's fitted with the skill that only master craftsmen can impart. Rifle stocks, same, are blocked from all sorts of stuff. Curly maple is the one. When you see something that looks all tiger stripey, that's generally what you're looking at. And it's, you know, kind of crafted to house the barrel very, very tightly. You get your decorative elements in there, and it's really cool. Anyway, the other little side piece there, and I know we're kind of running far afield, but I think it's all really good info and it's pertinent enough. There is evidence of someone who turned a persimmon piece of lumber into their rifle stock, and apparently it was about twice as dense for the same size, and I want that real bad. If any of you feels like making a persimmon rifle barrel for me, you just let me know. Anyway, when they make these rifles, Sullivan and company are keeping that piece of history alive. They actually were some of the folks, I don't know if it was Sullivan specifically, again, this is an older article, the complexity, the skill of 18th century gunsmithing, they keyed me into the fouling piece as a concept, because like a lot of folks, I thought we were mostly looking at muskets, and sure, there are fouling pieces, those exist, but I did not realize how prevalent they were. And that's really cool. I think it's really special. Anyway, we're going to go through what foulers are now that I've taken us through a little Colonial Williamsburg side journey. So in the 1600s, we talked about the Dutch a little bit, but we're going to go back to England as well. England saw the emergence of some specialized fouling pieces. These come in longer and shorter barrels, a little different than our club-butted fouler. And they're absolutely essential for wild fouling, as we talked about before. The longer barrels, which sometimes can reach 7 feet, dear God, I think they're talking about a punt gun, when in that particular source material were believed to offer really good range, which, no, that's not how that works. I know even now we talk about longer barrels equaling more accurate, but that's just not, there's way more to it than that, and all my gunsmithing people out there know that. Like, cool idea, but no, shorter foulers kind of laid the groundwork for today's sporting shotguns. That's where they fit now. If you're out there with your buckshot, your birdshot, you are replicating the trades of a lot of these hunters out there back in the frontier. Gervase Markham wrote a book in 1621 called Hunger's Prevention, which, yeah, that's a metal name for a book right there. Where he praised the virtues of longer barrels and recommended the flintlocks over the matchlocks for their reliability, in wet conditions. So he was halfway correct. Markham preferred something called hail shot, or smaller pellets, over single bullets for bird hunting, which is to say bird shot. practice that we still use today, unless you want to go chase down birds with slugs, which I would not recommend. The evolution of those pieces is going to go even further in the late 1600s, and now we're getting closer to colonial times, right? Shorter, more balanced guns are turning into the primary weapon for the sport of fowling. And by the late 17th century, England is producing these gorgeous balanced flintlock shotguns. My God. By the 18th century, fowler design has become more refined. The fit and handling, which is actually what prompted me to put the piece about Williamsburg in here, is going to be a primary focus because we're dealing with better precision over the long run. We're getting more durability. The quality of our parts and craftsmanship's going up. We're creating pieces that can last, well, maybe not a lifetime, certainly a lot longer. If you're a tradesperson and hunting is your trade, you've got something that can last you for a significant portion of your career if maintained correctly. The Spanish barrel, which is an innovation, was praised for its consistent thickness and safety, just like myself, and also influenced gun making pretty significantly. The scientific community began to challenge the notion that longer barrels offered better range, finally, which put us back to that shorter barrel stuff that we saw with French developments. Moving into the 19th century, so we're kicking out past the revolution at this point, the development of percussion locks over flintlocks. Of course, for those who might not be aware, matchlock, flintlock, percussion lock is generally the way that went. Wheel locks were a thing as well, but matchlocks are really going to be your focus for prior to flintlock tech. Anyway, percussion locks are going to make things even more reliable. You start to get shotguns that start to kind of resemble what we've got today. Obviously, we don't use percussion caps, but they're becoming more reliable, they're becoming more efficient, and because of that, they're becoming way more popular. We're also starting to see breech-loading shotguns, sporting guns. This is where it all comes together, right? Fowling piece is more than just a tool for hunting. It's been a catalyst for technological advancement, like we've just been talking about, and kind of a mirror reflecting the change of sport and society. So we have it for hunting, for survival. We have a guy literally writing a book, Hunger's Prevention, which is still really funny to me, to evolutions that it's going to go through with sports. And then as warfare prompts changes to firearms technology, we are starting to see upgrades to the flintlock, to percussion cap, to all these other things. They're kind of feeding each other, and it's very interesting to me. Now, you know, we started there, but American fowlers were assembled from foreign parts initially, where they used local woods for stocks because our, you know, lumber here is always rock. American gunsmiths were pretty resourceful and did not like to pay for shipping, as you might imagine. By the end of the 18th century, although the capacity to craft an entire firearm was established, it was still pretty common to use imported parts due to cost and time efficiencies. One of the major things we have here is that we have major labor shortages, right? There's so much to do. How many people, like, we're not an industrialized society, right? Not yet. Britain is. Their industrial revolution comes way before ours. The urbanization is coming way before ours. So a lot of our stuff, we're getting in much more efficiently, much less expensively, simply by ordering it in. The significance of fowlers is past that, though, right? They're essential tools for farmers, more than just hunters, for farmers who were the vast majority of the colonial population. We just talked about England's urbanization. Well, the colonial population does not have that and didn't really want it for quite a long time. And these firearms were used for hunting to feed those people. So we're not talking about professional hunters. We're talking about subsistence hunters. And they're using them to feed their families. They're using it for protection against various threats, because they're out in the middle of nowhere. There's incursions from Native Americans who aren't necessarily overly pleased that all their land is getting taken away piece by piece over the course of the late 18th and 19th centuries. And despite their widespread use, however, historical documentation of these guns is a lot more sparse compared to military weapons like muskets, which are, you know, again, like I just said, going in, I've been working in the firearms industry for a long time. I thought muskets were the predominant firearm of the time. I was wrong. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The shortest answer is when we study history, we study a history of warfare, we study a history of politics, we sometimes study a history of economics, and those are the primary routes we go down. So if we have a day-to-day thing, and the Fowler has all of the pop and pomp and circumstance around it as, like, you know, a farmer's plow, yeah, we're going to document that a lot less than a musket that we're using to rip our way through the continental United States when we are manifesting destiny or fending off the British or what have you. But it's more important, just like now, we talk about all these fun, kind of sexy SHOT Show development firearms. We talk about the AR-15. We talk about Michael Leal Ace. I talk about it Into the Ground. You guys already know. But what's the most important firearm that exists in the United States right now? Some of you might say AR-15, and yeah, okay, I get that argument. Some of you guys would say concealed carry, and I get that argument even more. But the 12-gauge shotgun gives you the most versatility for a single firearm that you can imagine. So you can hold four, and that's a hunter, that's a home protector. If you're not worried about concealed carry, that's a self-protector. That concept has not changed over the course of hundreds and hundreds of years. We're going to be pushing a millennium probably before that's done. We talked about club butt Fowlers earlier. I'd like to go ahead and talk about some others. Just so you have some terms to walk away with for the quiz that I'll never give you. So club butt Fowlers, we already talked about that. In the U.S. or colonies at the time, these are primarily going to be found in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And they're characterized by kind of their goofy looks. Even though Massachusetts and Rhode Island, obviously New England, but there's something called a New England Fowler, which are noted for their Roman nose profile, air quotes on that, which was influenced by French firearms. And while I don't have a picture in front of me, I'd be very curious to see if that French influence is what we were talking about before with the shorter barrels. I suspect that it is. You've got your Hudson Valley Fowlers. Wow, say that three times fast without sounding like an idiot. Celebrated for their Dutch design and influence. These guys are going to be large, ornately carved guns. These are going to be some of the more expensive ones, reflecting the Hudson Valley area's culture. You've got your British-style Fowlers, obviously. These are going to resemble British sporting guns and distinguished by their large size and specific stock profiles. You've got the Kentucky Fowler, which was the only term out of any of these that I knew coming in, which is kind of the grandpa to the iconic Kentucky rifle. These are very similar stylistically, but are designed for shooting shot rather than bullets. And I think if I were going to own any of these, Kentucky Fowler is going to be the way that I'm going to go. It's probably going to be cheaper too, although I haven't done research on that. You have one of a kind Fowlers, excuse me. According to my source material, there were plenty that didn't really conform to any of those classifications, right? And would incorporate used parts. They would incorporate custom designs. Someone wants a specific thing. Okay, master craftsman. You come tell me. Or let me come tell you what I would like, rather. And you tell me what it's going to cost. And we're going to get this thing made. It's going to take forever, but we're going to get it made. And then it's just my style. That's cool, too. Fowlers have cultural, they have economic impacts, just like shotguns do today. And they facilitated the expansion westward and it supported the colonial economy through hunting and defense both. As we wrap up here, it's clear that American Fowlers are not just firearms themselves, but they kind of tell the story of the people and the times that shaped them. The colonial United States would not be functional without them, and they are so under-discussed. They're so rarely talked about relative to your muskets, your rifling. Everyone loves to talk about the American marksman, and don't get me wrong, that's cool as hell. But I mean, let's talk about John Doe. In the same way we used to talk about officers of wars and not the grunt soldiers, let's find a way to get these underappreciated firearms back into the mix. When was the last time we talked about a Mossberg 500, right? It's really cool, I think. These guns are kind of a testament to the resilience and resourcefulness of early American settlers, and they're a significant part of our heritage here. Anyway, here's your little historical sidetrack for the day. Thank you guys for being so patient with this episode's release. It took me a little bit longer to put it out than I'd like, but it also merited a little bit more research than I normally do, to be honest with you. I probably read for an hour. No, more than that. I did a lot of reading is the point, and was able to do a little bit of interviewing to make that happen. So glad to share it with you. Glad to share some knowledge with you guys. And I hope you found this as interesting as I did. For now, that's the Gun Rack. Stay safe out there. We'll see you at the range.
Sonoran Desert Institute is an online school accredited by the DEAC. It is headquartered at 1555 West University Drive in Tempe, Arizona. For more information about how you can craft your firearms future, visit sdi.edu.